This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In just a few days, Only a Game will celebrate its 12th anniversary. Think of it. When Only a Game first hit the airwaves, Michelle Wie was 3 years old and scarcely able to break par. Nolan Ryan was still bringing heat, and the Texas Rangers, for whom he pitched, were owned by an investment group fronted by a man who was inclined to smirk, a man who would go on to front an even larger organization, the government of the United States of America. Major League Soccer was no more than a gleam in the eyes of the benefactors who would eventually improve your life, or mine at least, by bringing us the New England Revolution, D.C. United, and the rest. In recognition of the commencement of year XIII of Only a Game next Saturday, we've decided to take a nap for a week. So this week's show will consist of a reprise of some of our favorite stories from the past 6 months or so. We begin with a May conversation with the author of one of my favorite recent sports books, Sunday Money, subtitled A Hot Lap Around America with NASCAR. In order to write that book, Jeff McGregor spent most of 2002 immersed in the noisy world of NASCAR. From Daytona to Phoenix and New Hampshire to Alabama, he followed the rolling thunder of the race cars and lived among the fans. With the NASCAR season running 40 weekends with few breaks, I asked Jeff McGregor if he knew what he was getting into when he started the project.
Had no idea. It begins as all terrible crackpot schemes begin, with a simple conversation. I was talking to the guys at Sports Illustrated, and this is mid-2001, and we thought, well, there's a phenomenon here, clearly, that we have yet to address in a meaningful way. So why not go out and do a piece? And then some smarty jammies pipes up, why not do two? We'll do one about the racing and one about the culture. Mm-hmm. And then someone piped up yet a third piece, and the next thing I knew, I was living in the Walmart parking lot.
Much of the first part of Sunday Money is description of the various challenges that you faced driving your temporary home from track to track. Was living in a mobile home the only right way to research this book?
I thought so, and I'll offer a gentle correction. A mobile home is the thing that gets carried off in a tornado. a motor home is what we were stuck in, our tiny
motor
metal
home.
Box.
And I shouldn't laugh at tornadoes and mobile homes.
No. 30 years from now, you're going to know all about this way more than you care to when you're trying to find a good spot to park next to the course in Tucson. we really thought and thought and thought about, is there a way to do this? And there's a huge motorhome culture in NASCAR, unlike any other sport. At Daytona for the 500, the first big race of the season, those folks have been out there for over a month in some cases. So the guys at Lambeau Field who scream how they've been out there since 11 in the morning have got nothing on these folks.
Fairly early in Sunday Money, you characterize the attitude of NASCAR fans toward their heroes by writing, quote, "Carry us with you, we're saying, and do us proud. Remember us. Make us better." Is that an attitude peculiar to NASCAR fans, or is it something they share with fans of all athletes in all sports?
That's a great question. I think that in other professional sports, the attitude persists, but perhaps there isn't the opportunity to offer the gesture. It's very hard to get a glimpse of or get an autograph from your favorite NFL star or your favorite baseball star. These guys are available generally for 15 seconds, the length of time it takes to walk from the locker room to the bus after the game. But in NASCAR, it's a lot like country music. Mm. There's not just an encouraged but an almost enforced relationship between the drivers and the fans.
Of course, there is a dark side to this relationship. At a track in Pennsylvania, you witnessed a most dramatic demonstration of how fast a fan's admiration for a driver can sour. Tell us the story of Dale Jarrett and the two men rooting for him.
Well, I can only sketch it out schematically, as you know, because, again, the FCC has big, big ears. Dale Jarrett had just won the race at Pocono. And an oddity of Pocono, and there are many, but one of the oddities is that there are stands built up above Victory Circle there, and these two young men who were decked out in their Dale Jarrett UPS gear were standing above him shouting down into the noise and celebration of the post-race. And they clearly loved him very much. They admired him a great deal. But over the course of the next 5 minutes, Dale Jarrett never responded to their calls. He never looked up. He never turned to them. And in the course of that 5 minutes, you saw the entire arc of celebrity worship in America. you know, it begins with "You, the man, Dale," and ends with "We made you," in a very angry, angry way. And it was just such a telling moment for me.
Dale Jarrett refused to validate them on that occasion. That's what came to me from the passage.
I think so, but in Dale Jarrett's defense, he may not have even heard them.
Right.
There is no place louder in America than a racetrack, even when the cars are shut off. You've got to remember that between the confetti cannons and the 95th playing of, you know, the studio remix of Freebird, it's just deafening. I, you know, my wife and I now can only speak to each other when we're in the same room. Yelling from one end of the apartment to the other doesn't do any good because our ear bones have been ground to a powder.
You characterize one event at the Texas Motor Speedway as follows. The race is loose and rhythmic, with an accident every 50 laps or so to keep the fans in it. How would the average NASCAR fan feel about that description?
I think it depends on a fan's willingness to see NASCAR honestly. I'll say this. This is my disclaimer. Nobody goes to the track to see anybody get hurt. I think fans, though, very much enjoy, as did I, the idea that you could completely wad up a $200,000 race car, see it towed off the track, dripping fluids, useless, broken, and then see it reappear the next week. I think there was something very cathartic in that. I mean, if you live anywhere but New York or Boston or Chicago, or cities where there's a reasonable mass transit system, you have this terrifying love-hate relationship with your car.
Mm-hmm.
You love having it, but you're also terrified that something's going to go wrong with it. And I think this is a way for us to project our passive-aggressive loathing of our automobiles.
Jeff, NASCAR likes to promote itself as a sport that is at least as popular as any other sport in the country, but you argue that this contention requires the use of some pretty creative counting. Why is that?
Well, when I first heard the numbers, NASCAR's claim to 75 million fans, that seemed to me to indicate a little bit of optimism on their part. I mean, if you do a push poll where you cold call folks at home and say, have you ever heard of Richard Petty? You could probably classify them as a NASCAR fan if it was in your best interest to pump up the numbers. But then I heard things like, it's the highest per event attendance rate of any sport in America. If you take that per event attendance rate in NASCAR, 186,000 people per event, it's mind-boggling. But then you multiply that by 36 events, you wind up with about 6.7 million people have gone to NASCAR races. Whereas baseball, who tends to take the beating whenever NASCAR makes the comparison, put through the turnstiles last year 67 million people.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other area where NASCAR plays a little fast and loose with the numbers is in their television ratings. They compare their one weekly network broadcast to Major League Baseball's one weekly network broadcast. But we all know that everybody watches baseball on a local or regional or satellite basis. Something in the order of 30 million people a week watch baseball on television. And at a normal NASCAR race, middle of the season, you're going to get about 6 or 7 million viewers for that. So again, NASCAR is just doing what any business does. They're trying to put their best foot forward and sell their commercial time. I just think that their assertions needed some common sense fifth grade math, which is really all I possess.
At several points during Sunday Money, you recognize that NASCAR, that the phenomenon of NASCAR has implications beyond the sport of auto racing. Would you please read from page 332 in the book?
Sure, I'd be happy to. You could see the next war in it even then, hear it coming a year before we pulled the trigger. You couldn't miss it even if you didn't know which way to look or which war we'd fight. There it was, all around you in the honor guards and the booming flyovers, the bellicose benedictions and the defiant music and the thundering fireworks, hat over your heart for the anthem and standing razor straight, no matter how drunk you were or how cynical or disaffected. You were swept along by it, swept up in it, unquestioning. It was like seeing the American flag for the first time some weekends and 100,000 throats tightening with pride or sadness or mother love, love of country and love of freedom and love of horsepower and of Walmart and Junior and Tony and little Mark Martin and every other thing. And before you knew it, your eyes were wet with patriotism and your heart bent to every loss and went out to every 9/11 widow and sank for every corrupted American body on every battlefield since first Manassas. And sweet Christ, the firefighters and the cops, too, gone, the heroes of every boomer's second-grade reader, gone in the endless instant playing over and over on the national video loop, that fire blooming again and again, and the black smoke flowering, and the buildings and all those people falling. You couldn't get any of it out of your head, even if you wanted to.
It sounds, at least in that passage, as if you found yourself becoming part of something that was going on, something you were there to witness.
Oh, sure. I don't know that I'd say we went native. But at some point, you are borne along by that great American parade. And that was sort of the book, as it turned out over the course of that season. It had begun as this sporting survey of NASCAR, and it turned into this sort of cultural overview of a very wounded America in a very strange time in its history.
Jeff McGregor is the author of Sunday Money, Speed, Lust, Madness, Death, A Hot Lap Around America with NASCAR. It's published by HarperCollins. He spoke to me from New York City. Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
I'm the fastest in the land. Yeah! I'm a roadrunner, honey, and you can't keep up with me.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
I'm a roadrunner, honey, and you can't keep up with me. Come on, baby.
It's not the bear. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, anthem singers bursting bombs under the Rockets' red glare of a packed sports arena. But first, it seems every possible story angle is reported in the week or weeks before the Super Bowl. This includes poking fun at the host city. Jacksonville was the site of Super Bowl XXXIX, and it too took the customary beating from the assembled media. Matt Sergel, along with some of his co-workers at the Florida Union Tribune, beat everybody to the punch by compiling, with tongue firmly in cheek, a list of 39 reasons to make fun of Jacksonville. He joined us in February, and I asked why anyone would want to make fun of his hometown.
Oh, heck, I don't know. I guess it's kind of fun. It used to stink, the paper mills, but it doesn't anymore, I swear, unless it's a little low tide on the river, maybe, but that's a nice smell. I think it's maybe the Ville in the name, the fact that we've never been as glamorous as Miami or New York, certainly, or any place like that. Jacksonville is a small town, a small city that's just kind of grown up and into an actually pretty big city and quite a pleasant one as well, I think.
Well, do people who live there take offense at some of the pokes that they're taking in the media, or are they thick-skinned and used to it?
No, they're taking some offense to it and getting kind of upset. We did our story. We offered 39 reasons in honor of Super Bowl 39 to go ahead and bash our big city.
Well, I like those, some of your reasons. Have you got some favorites among these yourself?
Yeah, like the fact that our original name was Cowford. The Miami Herald, for example, never has a Jacksonville story without mentioning the fact that we were called Cowford, which is like, you know, 200 years ago. I inform a little erroneously, I must admit, that Cowford is an ancient Indian word meaning hot, flat, boring place by the river. So,
well, maybe I guess your strategy is beat them to the draw. On
that's
this,
right.
Obviously.
Yeah, and I point out that the college radio in town, True Fact, plays easy listening music.
Yeah.
And then we have like 18 classic rock stations and a strip mall for every taste and all that good stuff, you know?
I want to tell you, I did notice one of your Jacksonville bashes, I believe it was number 5, turned up in somebody else's article unattributed. This is the bash that reads, "There are so places to eat after midnight. You got a problem with waffles?"
People love our waffle houses here. What a... In fact, one of our sports columnists took a bunch of big city reporters out to a Waffle House the other day and wrote a funny column about that. So, and I people can go ahead and steal. I said, these are free to use however you want. Just take them and use them.
That's hospitality. Yeah.
Sure,
extreme.
Southern hospitality, which actually gets around to the point. This is an incredibly friendly city. Mm-hmm. I used to live up in Boston. I met more people in my first week in Jacksonville than I did in 5 years in Boston, as much as I love Boston. It really is an amazingly friendly city down here.
Well, and, let me tell you, just for the record, you didn't miss a thing.
Yeah. But actually, I got a huge response from readers, email and phone calls, and it was running about 3-1. People were saying, "I love the way you bash Jacksonville. I love it here, too." I mean, they really took it in the good spirit.
But all this happy talk notwithstanding, are any of the jabs against Jacksonville on target?
Oh, yeah, that's what makes some of them so good. It's not the most exciting place in the world if you're looking for, you know, endless nightlife and bikini models and all that. Well, we got plenty of that this week. But, you know, once the Super Bowl goes away, it's a place to people come and they think they're going to spend a couple years, and then they end up kind of staying around, and they like their house near the beach, and they like their sports teams, and they like the weather. Though, as I point out, it is unbearably hot 9 months of the year, but it's a wet heat.
It's wet heat, so it's all right.
Wet heat. Yeah, yes, it's okay.
I'll fix those people in the desert who think they've got it right.
I know.
When the Super Bowl is not in town, Matt Sergill is an entertainment reporter for the Florida Times Union. Matt, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. Thank you, Bill.
I've got $500 and suits with short collars. I don't swim, I love again. I don't swim, I love again. People will clatter. It doesn't.
Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org.
Away from frustration, it's my anticipation. It's called for elation. I go across the nation with no reservation. My 2 week vacation.
In April, at the Quebec Coliseum in Quebec City, Canadian singer Caroline Marcille discovered what lots of singers preceding her have learned. You cannot take lightly the responsibility of singing the national anthem before a sporting event. As 7,166 fans eager to see a hockey game between the U.S. and Canadian national teams waited, Ms. Marcille forgot the words to the U.S. anthem, started again and forgot them again, left the ice to get a lyric sheet, and, having returned, slipped and fell. This unhappy adventure is reminiscent of other anthem-related embarrassments. For example, sprinter Carl Lewis's attempt before a 1993 Nets-Bulls game to expand his career to include singing.
And the Rockets!
Uh-oh. 10 years later, before a playoff game between the Dallas Mavericks and the Portland Trail Blazers, it was 13-year-old Natalie Gilbert's turn to assault the national anthem.
What so proudly we hailed at the stars like stars.
Natalie's misadventure with Sir Francis Scott Key's text gave Maurice Cheeks, then the coach for Portland, a chance at an assist.
Come on. Starlight, last dream.
Stars, light,
last dream.
Last gleaming. Whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight. Oh, the ramparts we watched were so gallantly.
In that 2003 incident, Gilbert and Cheeks were joined by a fair number of fans. That, according to John Melman, is how anthem singing should always work.
They shouldn't be singing it by themselves. The 20,000 people that are standing around watching should be singing along with them.
Or at least drown them out.
Yeah, at least drown them out. That's exactly right. And it is an anthem. It's something that we all should be singing. It's not a performance piece. It's an an anthem that all Americans should be singing, and that was the original intent of any kind of anthem like that.
That conviction led Dr. Melman and the National Association for Music Education to initiate the National Anthem Project last month. The aim of the project is to encourage Americans to learn the words of the anthem and to sing it as well, a goal John Melman does not regard as unrealistic.
First of all, it's not that complicated, and people often criticize and say the song is very difficult to sing and so forth, and my response is, well, that's why you have music teachers.
Dr. Melman then demonstrated that it was not all that difficult to remember even the words to the rarely sung third verse of the anthem.
And where is that band who so valiantly swore that the havoc of war and the battle's confusion, a home and a country should leave us no more. Their blood has washed out their foul steppe's pollution. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. And the star-spangled banner and triumph shall wave where the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Nicely done, I'm sure, but is John Melman's performance representative? Could it ever be? I recently had the opportunity to visit with Rene Rancourt, who has been singing the national anthem before Boston Bruins games and various other events for over 25 years. I asked him if he'd ever worried about forgetting the words.
No. I was very cocky, as most beginners are. And luckily, I did learn my lesson very quickly because I was thinking of, you know, superfluous things. And obviously, I forgot the words.
It happened to you.
Yes, once, very early in my career. And unfortunately, it did hit the Boston Globe the next day. Very, very embarrassing. But the writer said, Rene Rancourt dooby-dooed his way through the national anthem a la Frank Sinatra, never missing a note, and left the ice to a rousing ovation.
The song is only a minute long. Why are the words so hard for people to remember?
Well, when you're home by yourself, you're taking a shower or shoveling snow, it's much, much easier to sing. When you get out there, there are all kinds of distractions. You know, you're worried about your hair, you know, and is my tie on straight? So every time I sing, I've been doing it now for 35 years. And it's been like 1,500 times just for the Bruins alone. So I say it's like a little prayer before singing. I mean, you go over the words and you meditate because I don't care how secure you might feel when you get out there, it's a different ball game.
Now, our senior producer, Gary Wallach, has a theory that one reason that people forget the words to the national anthem so frequently is that they are syntactically disconnected. It's not an easy sequence of
yes.
words to remember because it doesn't sort of follow logically
right, right.
one phrase from the next.
It's the most difficult thing. It's non sequiturs. I, last night, as a matter of fact, sang another national anthem. I sang the Australian national anthem. Would you like to hear a couple of words?
I would love it.
Words?
I would very much
Australians,
like
all, let us rejoice, for we are young and free. Now, it's unbelievable. And it ends like this. In joyful strains, then let us sing. Advance, Australia fair. Oh. What a ball.
Yeah, and I like that. No bombs, no blood, you know.
Well, actually, the most militaristic thing is the rocket's red glare.
And but really, bombs bursting in air.
Oh, that's right, too. I guess you're right.
Yeah.
But it does. See, I like to have a positive attitude about that. I like to think that it gives me a chance to be patriotic.
Beyond forgetting the words, national anthem singers also have problems with either the low notes or the high notes or both. There
yes.
is a real
yeah.
range problem for this song.
Yeah. The way I look at it is it should be a duet. It should be sung by, say, two people. Let's pick Robert Goulet singing the beginning of it. Oh, say, can you see, very macho, by the dawn's. And then the high part could be sung by Tiny Tim. And the rocket's red glare, the bomb tiptoe through the tomb, et cetera.
I like the bomb tiptoeing better than the bomb bursting. That's kind of nice. I like that image.
You can start very comfortably, you know, in a comfortable range. Oh, oh, say, can you see by the... And then you get further and further into the... And the rocket's red. You know, you have to say, what am I...
And you have this terrible realization that it's coming, the note that you can't hit.
Yes. Oh, yes. The range of the song is so weird that it you do have to have some vocal technique. However, if there's anything wrong with you at all that day, it will show up.
The national anthem will find you out.
It'll find you. I mean, I've experienced that many, many times. I just was not feeling well. I had a cold. I'll do it anyway, you know, that kind of thing. And that's when you are very happy that you did practice a lot. That has been my best friend because the technique has to be there whether you are or not.
There's another problem with the national anthem, with singing the national anthem, that we haven't discussed yet, and that is the acoustics in the places where you sing it. How long does it take to get used to hearing "Oh, Say Can You See" echoing back when you're already on rockets and red glare?
Yeah, that's impossible. Thank goodness that at the Fleet Center, there is no echo. But the worst place is Fenway Park. You start listening to that other guy. Oh, say, can you see? Yeah, and you start listening, you start waiting for the echo, and you're in big trouble.
Well, there's no echo in here, so maybe you could take us out with a portion of our anthem.
And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave?
Yay. Rene Rancourt sings the national anthem at Bruins home games and at many other events around New England. Rene, thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Only a Game. The Scripps Howard National Spelling Bee took place this June in Washington, D.C. Commentator Tim O'Shea looks forward to the day when his kids will take part in that competition. Oh, wait, no he doesn't.
There are many things I hope my kids will do with their lives, and I'm not picky. Astronaut would be good. Lion tamer sounds exciting. High school graduate, spokesmodel, or maybe place kicker for an arena football team would pass muster. But I pray my kids never aspire to be champion spellers. After watching the National Spelling Bee on TV last year, I vowed to do my best to ensure my children never make the trip. I don't have anything against good spelling, but the National Spelling Bee is to good spelling what the Indy 500 is to good driving. It looks like driving, it sounds like driving, but normal driving doesn't require helmets, pit crews, or fences to contain flying shards of flaming auto parts. And the National Spelling Bee is not normal spelling. For 15 rounds, well-groomed, pint-sized spell-it-alls slug it out over words like hypozeuxis and naphonic as their parents and spelling coaches, ponder that phrase for a moment, will you, fret, squeal, and videotape the event for posterity. My 10-year-old is learning how to spell frolic, picnic, and donkey, while those kids are nailing words like boudin, symphily, and dipnuous. I'll admit part of this bias is the fact I'm nursing a 20-year-old spelling grudge. As a 16-year-old, I won my high school's junior class spelling bee, crushing my competition en route to the finals, which were to be beamed via closed-circuit TV to the 2,000 students across the entire school. I spent days preparing, poring over dictionaries, attacking stacks of flashcards, memorizing word roots, origins, and derivations. When the finals began, I was pumped. So pumped that on my first word of the contest, I froze, panicked, and fell apart, misspelling the word belfry with two L's. There was an eruption of laughter, and I quickly snaked off camera, back to homeroom, defeated, deflated, and ashamed. My chance for victory got stuck in a misspelled belfry, and I never made much of an effort to be the best speller after that, fully embracing the power and grace of a reliable spell-checking program. So I'd rather let my kids succeed or fail in other things. Telling a group of people you'd been cut from an arena football team sounds so much cooler than explaining, if it wasn't for the confusion over the origin of the prefix, I had erythema in the bag. But if they do make the decision to go the route of the champion speller, I'll wish them my best but won't be making the trip to Washington. My picnic schedule's filling up, and someone's got to frolic with the donkey.
Tim O'Shea is a freelance writer who lives and writes in Concord, New Hampshire. That's N-U-H-A-M-S-T-E-R. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at Cabot Cheese.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, humans mushing other humans for fun. But first, a Canadian priest reeled in a world-record walleye through the ice last year, and he's using his catch to help devastated fishermen half a world away. In April, reporter Amy Jo Eamon brought us the story of the fishing father of Tobin Lake, Saskatchewan.
Hallelujah.
Marius Zients believes in the power of prayer, hook, line, and sinker. He's a Roman Catholic priest who loves to fish. When he's not administering to his flock, he's casting lures at Tobin Lake in rural Saskatchewan.
I learned fishing when I was about 4 years old in Poland with my uncles, 2 years younger than my brother is a priest too in Poland. You know, we pray and we fish together. Usually we make the kind of deal, when we catch a fish, we'll sing that song. Uwielbiaj duszo moja sławę Pana mego, chwal Boga stworzyciela tak bardzo dobrego.
That song is the Canticle of Mary, from the Gospel according to Luke, chapter 1, verses 46 to 55. It's about Mary, the mother of Jesus, and the namesake of Father Mariusz. He says that prayer of thanks every day near sundown. He said it one frigid Tuesday in early January while fishing from an ice shack on Tobin Lake.
It was quiet. There were other people fishing in other shacks, even some of my parishioners as well. They went by that well at that time, and I didn't catch anything.
He decided to drop his line one more time, say his prayer, and call it a day.
You know, I was jigging with a spoon, five diamond spoon, Len Thompson spoon, and with minnow on it. Then I was jigging, and, you know, when I start praying that hymn of gratitude and praise, that moment, you know, I felt a little nimble. All of a sudden, you know, I recognized it was a walleye, and it was a big one.
He proudly showed his catch to the others fishing nearby. They convinced him to have it weighed, just in case it was a record. The nearest digital scale was half an hour away at the grocery store in the town of Nipawin. And it was a whopper, 18.3 pounds, 36 and a half inches long, 22 and a half inches around. Within a few weeks, it was confirmed by the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame in Wisconsin. It was the largest walleye ever caught through the ice. Since that day, he's got a new nickname, Father Walleye.
Yeah, I like it. I really, it's stick with me. So I'm not afraid to say that I'm proud of it. No, because it's meaningful, because all the apostles, most of the apostles, the fishermen, you know, to be fisherman of men, and Jesus is using that expression.
Sure. I'll go press and open the cup.
Father Mariusz proudly totes his prized fish, now stuffed and mounted, in a large plywood box. He takes it from town to town in his parish so the curious can see it. But today the walleye finds a permanent home in his cabin at Tobin Lake.
All right, yeah. Open her up.
Yes.
I'm very excited.
Another fishing enthusiast has come to see for himself and snap a photograph of Father Walleye and his big fish.
Okay, I'm trying to get it all in the frame. It's too big.
Father Mariusz believes God gave him that fish for a reason, a feeling that was confirmed a few days later when he read a newspaper article about the fishermen devastated by the tsunami half a world away.
They said, you know, that we don't need any food. Just who's going to help us buy boats and fishing equipment, and we can manage ourselves. So I felt in my heart, really, that, you know, if I would be able, you know, with the help of other fishermen to buy one boat, really my mission would be accomplished.
Using the internet, he contacted a priest in India. He learned that a fishing kit, including a 30-foot boat, 3 nets, and a 10-horsepower motor, costs $3,000. He set up an account at the credit union in his hometown of Carrot River and has almost raised enough money for one full kit.
They set up the 6 families that would own that boat, and one within the 6 family would be one widow that would be sure that she gets the profit percentage of the money, that, you know, that is that her living livelihood is assured.
The publicity has also been a boon to the resort village of Tobin Lake. On a warm spring day in early April, the snow is melting, but there's still 3 feet of ice on the lake as fishermen head out on their snowmobiles. News of the record walleye spread rapidly in fishing circles. The story was carried on radio and in newspapers across Canada and the Midwest. It also swept the internet, spawning false claims that the record walleye was pulled from a frozen lake in Minnesota and Ontario. But at Tobin Lake, they know the record is theirs. Vince Walser runs a lodge and marina on the lake.
I've had people from North Dakota here, people from Montana here this winter, which we've never had before, and maybe they can be the lucky one and catch a new world record. There is definitely another larger walleye than that in Tobin Lake, and it's going to be caught.
Oh yeah, that's gorgeous right there. You can even bring it this way a bit. To the left. Yeah, right there.
Until the record is broken, Father Walleye's record catch belongs here on his cabin wall, where it will serve as a reminder that sometimes fishing is more than fishing.
I wasn't praying for fish. It was just a part of my, you might say, routines or time that I designate, you know, for evening prayer. In that particular circumstances, you know, that was kind of a sign for me there is a, you know, something bigger than that.
It's solid anyway.
Yeah. It'll remain forever.
For Only a Game, I'm Amy Jo Eamon at Tobin Lake, Saskatchewan.
In March, more than 80 mushers and their dogs set off on a journey of more than 1,000 miles. Along the way, those brave enough to compete in the Iditarod faced exhaustion, danger, and bitter cold. Meanwhile, in Lowell, a community north of Boston, nearly 60 mushers took on a similar challenge, sort of. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
You might think that in the moments before a national championship, the person in charge would be a little busy. But an hour before push-off of the 5th annual Human Dog Sled National Championships, Lowell Assistant City Manager T.J. McCarthy sits at a conference table on the second floor of City Hall, staring at the March Madness-style bracket he's set up for the evening's event. Maybe McCarthy can stay so calm because this competition is the national championship in name only. Or maybe it's because in the last 5 years he's made a science out of running this event. He even knows what to do if it doesn't snow.
We usually find it. We go to skating rinks, maybe go up to the ski area and hire a couple trucks to go up there and truck it in. Yeah, that's why Public Works Commissioner, the first year we did this, he said, boy, he says, now I've seen it all. He was usually yelling at me for not getting the snow off the street, now you're telling me to put it on the street. So it is pretty funny, yeah.
There's no lack of snow this time around. A blizzard in January took care of that. And taking the dogs out of the dog sled competition avoided another obstacle.
As a matter of fact, in the first year, I got a phone call one day from Peter in the way you say it here, PETA, up here in Boston, and they says Peter in Washington. We're like, Peter who?
That would be People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, calling to offer the city of Lowell an award for their animal-free event. A yellow bobcat stands by for last-minute repairs to this year's track. As promised, the Public Works Commissioner has filled the street in front of City Hall with snow and surrounded the course with bright lights and plenty of stadium seating. 2 dog sleds, straight from the L.L. Bean catalog, are set up for the 6-person teams, with designated positions for 1 musher, 1 passenger, and over-the-shoulder straps for 4 runners. McCarthy finishes a last-minute inspection of the track and is pleased.
The track is approximately 70 yards long, and it's about 25 feet wide. And they go down about 60 yards,
And the first sled to completely across the finish line is the winner. And they come back to the Thunderous 32 tomorrow.
That's awesome. Now, you know, when dogs do this, they go thousands of miles. Are
yes.
humans just lazy?
No, I don't know. I that's a question to ponder. I guess I don't know.
So far, the only actual dog in attendance is Yeti, an appropriately named Black Lab German Shepherd mix. According to his handler, JD, Yeti just couldn't stay away.
You know, he has to get his, you know, piece of the pie, so.
Is he just watching tonight?
Yeah, he's just a spectator. He's trying to give some coaching to the fledgling dog sledders, so. He's a longtime sledder himself, so.
Really?
You
know, he is?
Want to say hi, Yeti?
Well, be sure to give him all good advice, Yeti.
As the sun goes down, so do the temperatures, much to the dismay of the ladies of Dom Polski, a Polish national club. They crowd around the warmth of a barrel fire and show off their team spirit.
Go Poodles! Go Poodles! Go Poodles! Go Poodles!
The Dom Polski Poodles are dressed, appropriately enough, as red and white poodles. Their elaborate costumes include short frilly skirts, tails, and dog collars. But it's the white earmuffs that really make the outfit. Treasurer Karen Finch says warm ears are just one of the improvements over last year's design.
We have different costumes this year, bigger and better. We went third place last year.
You guys handmade your skirt.
Yeah, we're showing a little leg this year.
And why poodles?
Why not? We won last year. We're trying to win again.
The winners of the costume contest get $1,000 in gift certificates. The winners of the real competition get, well, bragging rights mostly, which they flaunt at every opportunity.
Yep. Are you guys the champs?
Yes, yeah. We are.
Mike Power is the head coach of the Lowell Nor'easter semi-pro football team. He led his team to the New England Football League AAA championship this season and is hoping to lead them to their third human dog sled national championship as well. Power and quarterback John Spidell say they're getting a little tired of seeing all the loot go to the costume competitors. So why didn't they join the fun and try to sweep this year's competition?
We were thinking about, like, serious cheerleading uniforms earlier today.
Cheerleading uniforms.
And win.
Gilligan's Island, stuff like that we thought about. But it's very hard to get football players to dress up like women.
Welcome to Winterfest! All five, ready for the dog sleds? Let's hear it!
The stands are packed for the opening run. Lowell's hometown boxing champ, Irish Mickey Ward, is on hand to judge the costume contest, and a curious group of gentlemen covered in tinfoil are getting ready to hit the track.
Who are you guys?
We're foiled again. This is our leader, Joe Parisi.
Actually, it's Justin Parisi, if you want to be accurate. You might not have to be on a first-name basis to pull a dog sled, but if you want to pull for Foiled Again, you have to work for a local environmental engineering firm and cover as much of your body in tinfoil as possible. Justin Parisi explains the strategy.
Actually, it does keep us warm.
Oh, good.
It does attract attention.
Yes, it does.
It is original.
Uh-huh.
And you can cover almost anything in it. Spoken by a true engineer.
Parisi has covered a 3-foot-long helicopter in tinfoil and attached it to a hard hat. As the teams dutifully approach the starting line, Parisi parades in front of the spectators, allowing his tinfoil helicopter to twinkle under the full glare of the stadium lights. After an entire minute of showboating, he takes his position on the team. Foiled Again doesn't have much to fear in their first heat. They're up against a group of bankers who get tangled up halfway through the race. Still, Foiled Again will be back for the Thunderous 32 tomorrow. The Middlesex Sheriff's Office sled dogs don't have to wait to find out if they'll make the Thunderous 32. They made it to the Final Four last year, which gave them a bye in the first round. If that doesn't give Rick Maloney and his team enough confidence, just factor in what they do for a living.
Special Operations Unit, SWAT team.
So you guys have to be in shape for a living.
Well, we try. We try.
Do you do any special training for this event?
None. None at all.
Do you even break a sweat out there?
Too cold to sweat. Too cold to sweat, but we work up a good thirst anyway.
Like all perennial powerhouses, the sled dogs have built up a rivalry, strangely enough, against the local gas company.
That's our competition right there. That's Keyspan. That's the enemy. That's the enemy right there.
Keyspan lost to the sled dogs in the quarterfinals last year. Brian Doe says the team has been doing everything they can to even the score.
Do you guys train?
Each and every day.
Every day.
For at least a month, yeah. We pull sleds weighing in excess of like 300-400 pounds. Yeah, we take this very serious. Oh, sure. These are conditioned athletes, these gentlemen right here.
Hopefully, all that training will come in handy, especially when you consider what's at stake.
We have servicemen waiting at each one of their doorsteps. So if they cross the line before us, we're going to shut all their gas off at their house.
Have they counter-threaded?
Oh, absolutely they have. They've said that if anything happens to their house, that they're going to get in their black uniforms, their guns, and they're going to put shock grenades in each one of our cars. Because that's a SWAT team. But we're not afraid.
In the end, the Lowell Nor'easters sealed their dynasty with a three-peat. The Shocking Electrics won the costume contest, and the grudge match between the Sheriff's Office sled dogs and Keyspan once again saw the SWAT team victorious. However, in the past week, there have been no reports of unexplained gas outages, and none of the SWAT team's shock grenades have gone missing. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Lowell, Massachusetts.
Okay, we're going to get going. Thank you very much. Have a good time.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Mike Toda. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Charlie Pierce, who's happy to take a much-needed break from sports-related diatribes and in Finland, covering a local wife-carrying competition.
I'm hopelessly lost in the Hainainen in the Sunkajärvi.
What did he say? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from Vision to Innovative Impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public.